You're listening to a day1.fm show.
Yeah, AI has been a huge tailwind. So our actual tagline is build in a weekend, scale to millions. And it's really not hyperbole. We've had 11 applications in the past year that spent maybe a week building their application with Superbase and then scaled up to, you know, over a million customers.
Welcome back to Diaspora.nz. We're on a mission to seek out and profile the hidden gems, the best founders, operators, researchers, and emerging leaders of the great Kiwi expat community. And we're back today with episode 3, this time getting up to the frontier of open source, of AI, of one of the hottest companies that spans the two. Superbase is an open source Firebase alternative. And if you're wondering what that means, in founder Paul Copplestone's words, if you're going to build your next startup, you'll probably choose us. We'll provide all the tools you need to get started, Postgres database, authentication system, file storage. And frankly, that's not just founder hyperbole. A very large number of the new startups I'm aware of getting started today are using them, including nearly a third of the recent Y Combinator batch. Paul's come a long way from his family farm back in Kaikoura. Today he leads a global company. He's personally based in Singapore but has 80 employees in over 30 countries around the world. They've raised 110 million from some of the world's top investors. They have ambitions for so much more. I love this conversation, so let's get stuck into it. Paul, welcome to the Diaspora.nz podcast. I'm thrilled to have you. I've been a long-time follower and I'm excited to jam on everything you've been through on this journey.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
I was browsing Twitter the other day, as I do, and spotted something along the lines of 246 companies in the past YC batch, 72 of them use Superbase, so 29% of the batch. That's wild. You've raised $80 million Series B a little while ago. Superbase seems to be everywhere. I want to get into that. I'm excited to talk about it, but I want to go back to the start. Walk us through your story. Where did you come from and what made the pool that we see today in front of us?
Probably as most of your guests, I came from New Zealand. So I guess that's the true origin. Born in Wellington. I lived for a few years when I was younger in Thailand. My family moved there for 3 years, but I was very young, 5 years old, and then moved back to New Zealand. And then we really moved around a lot, actually. Auckland, I moved down to a farm in the South Island when I was around 10 years old, went to boarding school in Christchurch and did my school and university in Christchurch, and then moved around a lot, Nelson, a few other places before jetting off, as many do.
Tell me about the farm experience. I've noticed this common theme around a lot of Kiwi founders seem to have upbringing somewhere interrelated with it, the farming experience. Maybe it's just the country or maybe there's correlation, not causation.
Yeah, I don't know why that would be, but it sounds like maybe there's a bit of Kiwi ingenuity going on, I guess. You have to get really involved when you're on the farm. The way that it happened for us actually was that we were living in Auckland at the time. My parents flew down to visit some family friends in the South Island just for a weekend. And then they came back and they said, oh, by the way, we've bought a farm and we're going to move there in 2 weeks. So it was 2 months or something. Can't remember what it was because I was 10, but that was it. My parents weren't really from a farming background. They just decided to give it a go. And that's where we spent the next 15 years of our life. It was down in a place called Kekerengu. It's near Kaikoura.
Do you think that the quick jaunt you had into Thailand, was that part of what set the scene for a career you built Southeast Asia since then more broadly? Or how did you sort of make that transition from NZ and freshpork.co.nz through into the big wide world of Southeast Asia?
The only thing, because I was 5 years old, right, I can't really remember too much of it. And probably the memories that I have are very manufactured based on stories that people have told me. But the main thing that it did was it kind of created this sort of international feeling in my brain, like it wasn't too daunting to live overseas. I'd already done it, even if I was five. And so that was kind of nice. And I actually haven't lived in Thailand, but spent a lot of time in Malaysia and Singapore, and now Spain and America and various other places.
Step us through the stepping stones into those. Like, I think Malaysia, you would found a company called Service Hero. Is that the one? Which looks like it's still around, it's still kicking. You've made a little bit of carved out a little bit of a niche in the on-demand services and home services market. How did that come to be?
Yeah, actually, it's a funny story because I knew that I wanted to get into startups and I didn't really know what startups were or how to sort of break in. I probably should have gone to Silicon Valley, but for whatever reason, I didn't. So I took a year off and I started traveling around the world. And at one point, I went to Oxford University in the UK to visit my friend. And he was having this big ball and I hung out with him for a week or so. And I met all his friends and they were doing an MBA. And there was this one guy there called Carl Liu. And he had been really early on in Groupon throughout Asia. And he had seen startups before and startup scale. And when I was back in Australia, my friend was talking to Carl on the phone, and Carl was saying, you know, I'm going to start this new business. And I just accepted a job with the Australian government. I didn't really want to do that. It was a contract, and they said, go away for 2 weeks while we put a business case together, because you're a Kiwi. It should be an Australian doing this job. So in those 2 weeks was that phone call with Carl. And Carl said, well, I'm looking for a techie. I need someone to build this. I literally just jumped on a plane the next day, flew to Malaysia, and we started building that together. So yeah, Carl's also a Kiwi. So it's kind of cool, two Kiwi farmers starting their services marketplace across Southeast Asia.
I mean, that's what we're here to find them all and root them out, because there's stories like these everywhere. Tell me about the Malaysian market entry, and knowing what you now know, would you have chosen to go there again?
Definitely the learning experience of doing a startup across three different countries. It's kind of like doing a startup on hard mode, and also as a service of marketplace. At the time, this is very much a way of just mapping a business from the US into another geography, and then doing that and trying to blitz scale that model. So that's the model that we ran, and it really needed a lot of adaptation. The consumer audience and the services audience in Southeast Asia is very different. So it was a hard business to run. Yeah, definitely. I would do it differently. But, you know, at the same time, you've got to learn these things on the journey.
The next venture, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you joined Entrepreneur First in Singapore as a founder in residence in the program.
Yes, actually, the country manager of Singapore, of Service Hero, was working there part-time. And he said, do you want to come join Entrepreneur First?
Can you give us a run through like the program for anyone that's not aware of how it's structured? And, you know, there's similar concepts like Antler is in Sydney and elsewhere in the world, but it's talent investing, which is not venture investing as such. What are your thoughts about having been through a program like that and seeing it within the ecosystem like Singapore? Did you get a lot from it? Did you meet people? Did you have the growth and progress you wanted to see?
They basically take 100 people who have got three different edges, and an edge is kind of like a background. One edge is someone who's a product person like myself and can build a product. Another can be a domain edge, where it might be someone who knows everything about advertising or everything about music. For example, we had James Brown, drummer, in our cohort. And then the third edge is what they call a tech edge, but more like a PhD student. They might know everything about, say, quantum computing or something really wild. They throw you in a room, and for 3 months, you have to pair up with one person, find an idea, and then launch that particular idea. So at the time, I got this crazy Venezuelan mathematician, and we started building a lot of tooling around the metaverse well before the metaverse was a thing. So augmented reality, a lot of tooling.
This is in 2020 or so, wasn't it?
2018, I believe it was. 2017, even maybe.
You did get ahead of the metaverse craze, but you came out not in the metaverse, but in the physical world, because that was, and that was the connection, I think, to Service Hero, because Nimbus for Work was personal housekeeping all over again.
So Daniel, the person who put me in Entrepreneur First, and basically I went through Entrepreneur First, and one of my key criteria was just finding a really good founder. Your co-founder is really important for various reasons. They talk about it being like a marriage, and actually it's quite different, but it's still important, or almost same. Yeah, I went through Entrepreneur First and just thought, look, I want to do something with someone who I know is going to grind for the next 10 years of their life, because that's basically what a startup is. And Daniel was that person. So after Entrepreneur First, I had already been helping Daniel launch Nimbus. And he said to me, can you help me just build the product around it? And so I said, well, I want to do a DevTools startup. And he said, give me a couple of years at least. So basically, yeah, I was building my next startup while building the technology for Nimbus for Work.
So far, it sounds like you've almost ended up in Southeast Asia by accident. Is that true? And how would you think about recommending somebody who's going to move there today? How would you reflect on or say, like, what someone back home might misunderstand or underappreciate about Singapore or Southeast Asia?
There's a reason why I've been here since 2015. Singapore in particular is just a very efficient country. It's an amazing place to live. It's very diverse. It's great for getting around Southeast Asia, and it's great for building a startup. There's just really a lot of good reasons. I mean, I can't speak highly enough of it. Apart from one thing, the only downside is the time zone with America, which is unchangeable. But other than that, everything else is amazing.
Have you just time shifted your body clock to handle it, or are you working asynchronously enough that it's not a problem?
Our whole company is asynchronous. We've got people, I think, in nearly 30 countries now. So we've just geared up the company to operate that way. And the truth is, I have to travel a lot for work anyway. So I'm always shifting time zones, and we make it work.
Well, let's take the segue to talk about it then. Give us a download on Superbase, and particularly excited to hear about sort of how you're building it, given that entirely asynchronous global team.
Well, so Superbase is a platform for developers. What does that mean? It means that if you're going to build your next startup, then you'd probably choose us, and we'll provide all the tools that you need to get started. So we provide you a Postgres database. We have an authentication system. You can store large files with us and videos, images. You can write these edge functions and distribute them around the world. So really, it's just all the tools that you need to build really fast. If you're familiar with Firebase, then we're positioned as an open source Firebase alternative.
I mean, by contrast, like in a world pre-Superbase, or if Superbase didn't exist, what are people doing to stitch together these services? What would they be building with otherwise?
Maybe if you're familiar with some of the cloud providers, AWS, you might take your RDS database, and that's Postgres. Then you might use some Lambda functions for serverless. You might upload files to S3, and you kind of plumb it all together. We try to make these decisions. We know that you're going to choose Postgres, you're going to choose some edge functions, you're going to do all these things. And we choose open source versions of each one of these tools that you're going to use anyway. And then we create this amazing developer experience around them. So we've got these client libraries and JavaScript and Rust and Go and whatever you want, Swift for mobile. And then the idea is we make it really easy to use in various ways. You can use it on the web, on mobile. You could use it on classes. People write games with it, just because of the way that we've architected the system to be very universal.
You've said a few times that you take a lot of the tools that people would otherwise be using and particularly focus on open source tools, which means that they are out there that people can use them. They can fork the code directly and implement it. How do you think about what you build being publicly available and freely available for anybody to use versus what sits behind a paywall? Or put another way, like how does the business work behind this? What are people subscribing and paying you for as opposed to using themselves directly?
Yeah, it's a really common question in open source. Oh, you know, what if someone hosts it themselves and then, you know, capture the revenue or something like that? So first of all, philosophically, and my co-founder is called Ant, and to myself, are just philosophically open source people. That's just how we like the version of the world. And we didn't even really talk about, you know, should it be open or should it be closed? We just wanted to build an open source company. And that's really what I want to spend my time doing. Now, the way that we think about it is we put everything out in the open. The only thing that's kind of not is the ability to spin up the infrastructure. So, you know, that's all behind private repositories. I mean, got a lot of security code inside it. We don't want to expose a lot of this plumbing around our clouds or something like that. But if, you know, you want to host Superbase yourself, all the code is there. You just do a Docker compose up on a server and you literally get the same tools that we host for you. The way that we make money from open source is that we have a hosting service. So you can sign up like on superbase.com and you click launch database and we'll launch all that infrastructure for you. And then you just get started immediately for free. And if you like us, then you can upgrade, you start paying. And I think really this is where a lot of the open source monetization or the world is going. So I kind of split open source into two categories. You can have infrastructure or you can have libraries. Infrastructure is actually a lot easier to monetize. You can do hosting. Libraries, let's say you just write a JavaScript library where you can't host it. It's very hard to monetize these type of things. So for us, yeah, we focused really on the infrastructure side, making that easier for developers.
When you think about something like that, YC Tweet, there's 72 companies using Superbase. So are they using the hosted Superbase as your customers, or are they using either one or the two? And I'm very curious, if people do choose to host themselves, do you have any real interaction with them? They're not your customers as such, but they are members of your community, right?
No, so those 72 are all using our hosted service. And in fact, we don't put any telemetry or anything around our open source version. So we don't know. You can go at it. The only way we would know is if you tell us, or if you create a GitHub issue for us, something for us to fix. So yeah, it's really just for the YC community. For those who don't know, Y Combinator, we went through the summer 20 batch right when COVID was happening, the first COVID batch. And then if you go through YC, you can offer a deal to all the other YC customers. And so we have this deal. I think we're in the We were the number one deal in YC. I think we're in the top three. It kind of switches between a few every so often. So yeah, we're just really popular for builders, people who want to build things really fast, like YC companies. They want the tech to get out of the way so they can focus on their customers. And so our deal is very popular amongst these builders.
I love that framing of it. Is the decision not to wrap any sort of analytics over the open source element of it, is that intentional, strategic, or is there just sort of a body of work there that you didn't prioritize to measure that?
We just don't care, to be honest. I think like if you want to self-host it, that's great. That's just a different profile of customer who, you know, we're not going to try to target you or anything like that. You probably just want to get on with it, host it yourself, save a couple of bucks by spending 3 hours. We're never going to convert you into a paying customer, probably, if you're that profile. So we're just going to focus on the type of customer who just wants to pay us $25 a month.
I was thinking less about converting customers and more about strategic benefits, like looking at people and how they're using the product in order to spot, you know, possible future iterations or applications of your product. And or maybe it's recruiting. And I've heard it was either you or Ant speak about the open source recruiting benefit, which I love. So I'd love to hear it from you because it's a hack. It's an incredible superpower.
The funny thing is that, you know, I mentioned that Superbase is kind of in 30, it's in, I think, around 30 countries around the world. We actually operate a little bit like an open source community. Our company does. So we're very asynchronous. A lot of written culture. We do use Slack for a lot of the stuff, but when we're going to do big projects, it's all written. I think it happens just because we've been hiring all these open source maintainers. So the very first true open source hire was this guy, Steve from Peru. We were in 2020 going through the YC batch. And during YC, they tell you, do not hire anyone, just focus on your customers. And I had reached out to Steve. He was the maintainer of this tool called PostGrest. And it creates a auto-generated REST API on top of your Postgres database. Yep. I just reached out to him to say, hey, look, we're thinking about building this. I had had some email interactions based on my blog post. And I said, are you okay with us, you know, hosting it? I don't want to, you know, maybe you want to do it yourself. I don't want to tread on anything. And he said, no, we're not going to do that. We're just looking for maybe some sponsorship, $250 a month. And I thought, well, that's an easy one. $250 is not that much for something that's going to power a lot of databases, hopefully. And he said, I'm going to use that $250 to pay myself to work on it full time. And I just thought that was insane. So we said, do you want to join Superbase? And we went to the YC partners and they said, yeah, hire this guy immediately. If he's going to be part of your sort of technical strategy, then you need to, you know, make sure that he's working full time on it. So, you know, that was the first open source hire. And since then, we've just got dozens of these stories of people contributing to our community or to our open source repos. And then they're kind of too good to ignore. And we just make them an offer to join the company.
It's such an unfair advantage. A little anecdote for you as well is in Nondex, you know, scale years, we grew to about 250, 260 people, and well over half of them had been hired the same way as through a community. You launch a community, you observe who are the major contributors. They rise above the rest because they're doing so much to pay it forward. And we actually develop a sliding scale of employment. You start at one end, you're a passive community member, then you're an active, then you're a super community member, then you're a part-time employee, then you're a full-time employee. And you could be any one of those. And we even saw people go back down the stack from being full-time employees to part to, you know, active community members after leaving as well, which is really cool. I read something about enterprise sales versus product-led growth strategy. You'd written a blog about it. And I think there's some similarities where you look at sort of community growth in the early days to monetization to crossing the chasm. And there was a really interesting learning around like what not to do, customizing around enterprises. Can you walk us through that? Well, is either that blog or that thesis around enterprise sales?
Yeah, this one actually came from a discussion that I had with one of the YC partners who is the CEO of a very popular open source tool. And basically, the journey happens always the same around open source if you're not careful. So you start off, you build a tool that people love, you target indie developers, and you start growing through product-led growth. People like your tool, so they suggest it to other people. And your community starts growing and growing. And eventually, you realize, oh, look, we're making some money. And these enterprise customers start coming to you and they say, oh, I'll give you $1 million if you make this, you know, just adapt it a little bit, or you host it in this way and you do this and you do that. And $1 million sounds probably pretty nice. So you start working on these like snowflake customers. Everyone's got a different thing that they want from the product. And eventually, you know, your revenue is going up because you're getting all these enterprise customers. Then eventually, as it always happens in business, your revenue starts slowing down from the enterprise. It's not growing quite as rapidly as it was. And you look back and you think, oh, you know, what's happening here? And you dig into the numbers and your community has kind of papered off because you've been neglecting them for a while. And so that's the point when they say, oh, you know, we should reinvest in our community. But at that point, it's too late. It's kind of like glass. You can't go back to your community and suddenly try to reinvigorate your community. You've got to focus on them always. And so the idea around layering in enterprise sales is very much trying to make sure that your product is more around configuration items that you can give them so that they can do it themselves. But you'll only build things that are widely applicable for 1,000 customers, not for this one special customer. And if they need it, add it as a configuration item that they can change themselves. It's treating enterprise customers like product-led growth.
To play that back, as you grow, the key would be taking what otherwise have been an enterprise customization request and turning it around and saying, how can we standardize this and make it a configuration of our product that they can then go and deploy themselves. And by virtue of doing so, everybody else can go and deploy that same configuration or a different configuration using the same tools would be right.
Yeah. And being okay saying no, I think is really important. I mean, you have also a community to uphold. You've only got so much bandwidth. So saying no to the things that are going to take 6 months to build is probably more important for your long-term health, even if it means that you miss out on, you know, $1 million here and there.
I'm just picturing you sitting in a board meeting and explaining to a venture capitalist that you're going to forego an extra $1 million here and there. Have you found yourself like evolving the approach as you've scaled and raised more money and become a large enterprise yourself? How have you built the discipline internally to remain true to that prioritization of the community?
Superbase has not yet truly crossed the chasm. I think a good example, which maybe you pointed out to me, was Atlassian. They're very good at saying no to customers who eventually come back. And honestly, this is going to be more and more repetitive for us. So for us, we need to still layer in a lot of the sales machine that will fit the product-led growth. So it needs to be truly integrated. I think a lot of the time it's a temptation to build two different operating models, whereas we're very focused on building an integrated model. So I guess let's revisit how well that goes in 2 or 3 years.
A lot's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years. One thing I have my eyes on is just this rapid lowering of the barriers to building things. And I think this is a huge tailwind for you guys. I'd love to hear your view from your seat on what's coming next as AI empowers individuals to build what previously they could not have. What are the second order effects that are going to affect Superbase and you personally? How do you think about this?
Yeah, AI has been a huge tailwind. So our actual tagline is build in a weekend, scale to millions. And so it's really not hyperbole. We've had 11 applications in the past year that spent maybe a week building their application with Superbase and then scaled up to, you know, over 1 million customers. And almost all of them are AI applications. And some of them are just indie developers. They're not a team of people. They're not that technical. Maybe they're starting to hire technical people now, but they really didn't know so much what they were doing. It's really becoming a phase of easy for indie developers. The tooling is getting easier. You can scale faster. We had a really good tailwind. So Postgres, the good thing about it, and also the bad thing, I guess, is that it can be used for everything. That's bad because the VCs always ask me, what is your ICP? Like, who's building with Superbase? And I just have to tell them that basically you can use it for anything. But that's great for us because the tailwinds, I mean, in 2021, the tailwind was Web 3. Everyone was building with Web 3. In 2023, it was AI, and we saw a huge bump in growth from AI. Basically, there's this thing with databases where you want to store your embeddings inside a vector database for doing some semantic search. So we were the first cloud provider to offer PGVector, which allows you to store embeddings inside Postgres. And then we've worked really closely with the PGVector maintainer and actually AWS and a few other companies to make that tooling really, really cool for developers.
You use the word indie developers as well to sort of connect that to a theme here. It's basically people who aren't sitting out to build the next venture-backed unicorn. They're sitting out to build products that generate revenue that you know, can also scale to be very large, but don't have to necessarily. And I'm really interested in your view on both sides of the table here, because you're also an angel investor and you're doing a lot of investing. I think you've mentioned this thesis for open source projects specifically. There's clearly a little bit of just like supporting the ecosystem going on, but like, what is your thesis for investing? And if somebody were going to come and pitch you, like what would you be looking for in them?
There isn't much of a thesis. If I like the product, the tool, and it's something that I would use myself, and I really like the founders, then I'll probably invest. Some savviness around startups definitely helps. So it's no good if you just want some angel investment, but you're not going to follow on with seed and series A and everything. If that's the case, you don't understand the next stages of the business, then you might as well just be an indie developer. But if you're going to lean into the venture capital, so you talked about indie developers versus VC, I think they're kind of two different routes. Don't half-ass either of them. Just go all in on whatever route you want. And if you are going to do angel investment, then you need to do a VC route. And there's nothing wrong with either of them. They just are two different tracks.
With that comment, you must be able to delineate what is venture backable versus what is on an indie path. And obviously, it's better if the founder knows that themselves and can pitch you on one or the other. But how do you look at something like longevity in this space? Some of the applications that you've seen go from zero to a million over the course of a week may not continue growing from there. They might bottom out again. You see a project, what gives you the confidence that this one has the longevity as a venture or an angel investment for you, as opposed to this is a great project that should really be on the indie track?
AI has definitely thrown a bit of a curveball in there, because I guess when you have this sort of platform shift, anything can change, and even giants like Google might get taken up, right? So basically, it's impossible. What I have to estimate is, you know, what the tooling, and I only really invest in developer tools, right? So I have some rough ideas of what I think the developer tooling might look like in 5 years, and maybe will this tool exist in 5 years or something close? You basically want to be the picks and shovels of the industry rather than probably some consumer-facing technology.
It's going to be a fun ride, no matter where you're sitting in it, that's for sure. Just changing gears a little bit, another one of, by the way, thank you for your blogging in public. Anybody listening to this should go and check it out. I'll make sure it's in the show notes. But another one I loved was the Why Nations Succeed. And I remember writing something. It was perhaps off the back of the Mark Anderson Time to Build, early COVID rallying of entrepreneurs to solve the world's problems, which is personally really inspiring to me. You had a line in there, and I want to kind of bring this into land with a bit of a thought about the New Zealand national identity. How much of an affiliation do you feel to that? Can you walk us through the Why Nations Succeed broad thesis to the extent you can recall it from 4 years ago? And any observations on sort of your own identity as part of the New Zealand diaspora or not?
I think the early thesis was, I heard this ridiculous stat around Germany about their efficiency, where they went from a nation after World War II, and they just kind of transformed. Not only did they transform their economy, which was in absolute ruins, but the image of themselves. And it's hard to think that it's like less than 100 years ago. It's just people were still alive from then. And Germany, which had this image, which is extremely tainted, now is just one of these countries in the world which has kind of got a seat at the table with almost everything. I was fascinated by that. And this kind of maps as well to my thinking of companies. Like, how did they do it? Largely, it was because they took what they'd done and they said, all right, that is no longer us. They just left it behind and they wanted to transform. They said, you know, kind of never again. And they left that whole identity behind and just focused on the future. That I found really fascinating. And I contrasted it with my partner's French. So I know that they hold very dearly to the Enlightenment movement from a couple hundred years ago. So contrasting how Germany and France had, you know, performed, and it's pretty interesting.
The cultural national one certainly is. The company metaphor, I think, here would extend to like reinventing yourselves as leaders. Or a quote I always liked was thinking about new hiring, and does this hire grow the culture? Not does it fit the culture, but does it grow the culture, and is it what we need in the future? I'm curious if you have any expansion on that in your experience as the team has grown. You're 60 people now, you said, I think, or thereabouts.
No, we're 80 people now.
Wow. It's growing quickly. You've also got a pretty broad array of interests. I think like the blog lists range from like soil health to mimetic theory to Buddhism to beyond. How do you go about learning so much stuff and synthesizing it? And what's the, is there a process behind this?
Not really. I think curiosity is just a good trait. And if I see things that I like, then I'll go deep on them and yeah, just really learn about them. And each one of those topics that you said is deeply fascinating. I think as with anything, the deeper you go, the more interesting these things become, even mundane topics. So often, I guess the way that I treat my blog is that when I find an interesting topic, I kind of earmark it for later. I might just drop a link in my blog and then I'll come back when I'm bored one day and go really deep on that particular topic. Yeah. Mimetic theory is actually one, if you're doing startups, this one is kind of a gold standard. I read this very, very interesting blog post. I think it was called Peter Thiel's Religion. And mimetic theory, high level, is this idea that, let's say you see me eating an ice cream and I say, oh, this ice cream is delicious. Then you will think, oh man, I really want an ice cream. And actually, if you see our marketing, Superbase's marketing, we've never paid for ads, but our community is very big. And the reason why is we kind of push this idea to its limit. You know, if people are building, we promote that people, if people are saying good things, oh, Superbase is good. We use that as, you know, within our community to show off that, hey, other people like Superbase. Maybe you'll like it too. And this is the thing, because of human nature, it's better coming from someone else rather than from us. And so we really push this mimetic theory throughout our marketing.
Which dumbed down for me is make good memes.
Yeah. Well, that as well. Yeah.
In seriousness, the Superbase Twitter account is actually a great follow, which is not always true, or is not usually true of hub sort of company branded Twitter accounts. And so you guys are doing a great job of that as well. Final question. And this is just throwing it your way, I think. My favorite wrap is just, how could we help you? Are there any upcoming challenges that you've got ahead of you? Any lines you want to throw out there for people who want to get in touch and make introductions for you or otherwise support you in any way?
You know, from our side, we just love people getting involved in Superbase, the community. Either you want to build something, so if you're going to build, please build it with Superbase and give us feedback on how we can improve. Or if you want to contribute to open source, get involved somewhere. Yeah, just anyone helping to foster the community would be great. So superbase.com is our website. Then the GitHub is, well, actually there's a short link, which we just acquired, git.new/db. So that'll take you to our GitHub. If you want to give us a star or follow along, and we'll do all our releases there. You know, you can contribute in many ways, just watch our videos and get involved and drop some comments, or we're on Reddit and all over the place. So yeah, find us anywhere.
Awesome. Thank you, Paul. It's been a pleasure. We'll look forward to chatting again soon.
Thanks, David.
That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. As a quick reminder, make sure you hit subscribe in your favorite podcast player so you can keep hearing stories like this landing in your feed every Friday, power you through those weekend chores. I want to give a quick shout out to the boys at Supermix who do all our editing. Zach and Xavier are Kiwi expats themselves. They're building a thriving business in the heart of New York City. A lot of respect. Not a sponsor, just a happy customer here. Also, for my day job, I'm an entrepreneur in residence and an investor at Blackbird Ventures. We're backing the best Kiwi founders wherever they are in the world. My personal sweet spot is pre-seed and seed. I like to say no check is too early, so drop me a line anytime. That's dbooth@blackbird.vc. We'll look forward to seeing you back next week.